right. Hi, I am Carolyn Lovewell. You are listening to the Sleepover Podcast. We're on vacation in Tulum. Lucky, blessed, grateful us. And I'm here with my wonderful husband, David Lovewell.
Hello.
And our dear friend, Frank Cafardi.
Hello.
And I just really enjoy listening to David and Frank talk. They've been besties for many years, and they share many interests in common, including a really beautiful understanding of Germanic paganism and the great work and runes and all sorts of fun stuff. And the other day, they were talking to our mutual friend Rory, who many of you have also heard on this podcast, and they were talking about some stuff that I really wanted to capture. I want you guys to hear about it, too. And also, let's see, what was it? Oh,
Lucy's
walking by. Our friend Lucy is walking by.
We're doing a podcast if you want to
If you feel like joining us, Lucy, you can. And we also have our baby and Lulu with us, so you might hear them. And, I just want to give a shout out to Frank's sister's friend, who happens to listen to this podcast and heard Frank talk the other day. And I just think that's super cool, and that your sister's friend must be a really deeply cool person, Frank.
Nicole Richardson.
Nicole Richardson. Shout out to Nicole Richardson. You win. We were very happy to learn of your existence and that you enjoy this podcast. And likewise, all of you listeners, you're very wonderful and special to us and obviously amazingly rad people. And your sister.
They don't have to know my sister.
You don't have to personally know Frank's sister in order to be cool, is what we're saying. But what's your sister's name?
Maggie.
Yeah. Maggie, you're super cool too. So, So, these guys were talking to Rory about a concepts like, I hope I'm pronouncing them halfway correct, but like Filja and
Filgia.
Okay, and the other one?
Hamingia.
And how they work together to create somebody's, you know, fortunes, basically. And I guess I just wanted you guys to talk about this, if the folks at home, and you were talking about the Hammer also, and all sorts of deep stuff. So if the folks at home wanted to really improve their fortunes and understand these concepts more, how would they do that?
Well, the context of these things is, you know, every spiritual tradition throughout the ages has what people like to call soul lore or like soul craft. It's basically maps of the self. And in our modern world, we kind of just have distilled it down to body, mind, and maybe spirit gets thrown in there depending on the circle. But ancient cultures were more precise and had many more words for the subtler aspects of being. So in Old Norse specifically, which is, you know, connected to English-speaking peoples in general through...
English is a Germanic language.
Yeah, through the metagenetic development of being through languages. If you speak English, this stuff can apply to you. So they had eight or nine parts, depending on who you ask. Some will say three or four. But two of them that...
Okay.
Are really similar and interact with each other are the Hamingia, which translates, most people say, to luck, and Filgia, or Filgjur in the plural, which translates to follower. I could go on and on about this stuff, but we'll see. Which, you want to pick one to talk about, Frank?
I mean, I got a lot to say about both. I can't really pinpoint one.
Well, how do they interplay together? And then tell us more about them individually.
So, Filgia is a follower. And I forget who I heard describe the higher self as the self ahead of myself. Mm-hmm. And I think of that as a good connection to the Filgia. It is... fetch in like modern English, people talk about their fetch, their familiar, their follower spirit. It's often like lots and lots of folklore stories back in the day about if you saw that you would see this spirit before you died. It was a portent of death. If you saw it, that meant you were going to die. Mm-hmm. And that, like, if you saw it, you were going to die within a couple days, pretty much. And if you saw it and you didn't die, that was a sign that you were becoming basically a witch or a shaman. These were the people that started to have that connection with the other side and have died before they die. And so they have that connection with death and the other side while they're still alive and can work with that for the benefit or detriment of other beings. And so Carolyn likes to talk about time loops a lot. And I think that that's, she's inside right now, but I'll just keep going. The connection to the filia, this part of your spirit that goes ahead of you in time and follows behind you. It's just like a wider radius in the nonlinear sea of time that we're swimming in. It perceives wider ranges and connects those messages to us and protects us and guides us.
Ideally connects them to us. Not everybody
can. Yeah, ideally. And they would say some people don't have one of these, some people say. But I think that everyone does. There's, in the sagas and all these things, it's, they say, like, your family has one, your tribe has one, you as an individual have one. And so there's different levels to it, the way that it manifests. And
this reminds me of something we were talking about the other night.
The Hemingia is a lot of times talked about in the same way as the Filgia. Some people see it as a distinct spirit in and of itself. But I like to see it as the bandwidth of the connection to your higher self. So we say, and ideally it gives you these messages. The more that you connect with your higher self, or the more that you build up your luck, you're developing this bandwidth going from dial-up to, you know, fiber optic and beyond, this high-speed connection of information being relayed between you and this follower, familiar spirit. And the cool thing about both of them, like I said, they're written about in similar ways, is that they're inheritable. For good or bad, like it has like a family curse or whatever, like
trauma.
Yeah, it's just like there's powers that come with it, but there's also like issues that it has that come with it. So it can be inherited and passed on to spirits. It can also be lent out, specifically like Hemingia and luck. It would say that you can lend it to somebody to give them a boost in a certain endeavor, and you can call it back to yourself. And so it's like a force of luck, but it also has a bit of a personality and a mind of its own. So this is where this overlapping and blending between the two ideas happens. You know, it's more of a spectrum of vibration of being rather than like sharp, hard, different aspects, that it all blends together in ways. And I can keep going, but I'm just going to pause and see if Frank wants to.
Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
Well, one of the things that I actually can't remember if you mentioned this just now, but one of the things that the thing about the filia that is interesting and that I've always kind of weirdly resonated with is it oftentimes will appear as a woman or a feminine spirit.
Well, contrasexual. If you're a woman, it would appear as a man.
Okay, okay. Well, mine always appears as a woman. And I've found that I've had dreams where this mysterious, mystical woman has, like, come and talked to me or stood with me for an experience in the dream. I actually recently read a dream that I wrote down to you guys at your house back in Pittsburgh like last week or whatever. And it featured this woman who I believe is a representation of my filia. And then also the other night, we were sitting out here talking about weird spooky stuff that happened in the past, and the lady who like saved me from getting crushed by a TV stand thing or whatever, the
invisible ghost lady that he doesn't remember lady. Talking about, but his sister remembers him telling her about
her.
So tell that little story. You were in your room as a kid.
So listen, I kind of remember this very vaguely, but not. I was in the first house that, like, I ever lived in with my family. And it was an old, like, house. Our family passed it down from many generations. And this house was probably haunted. But it was not haunted in a bad way, I don't think. Not to me, anyway. There was a time that I can recall where I was... I can't really recall it that well, like I said, but I was playing in the bedroom, and there was a TV stand, and I climbed up the TV stand, and it fell on top of me. And my sister came in and freaked out.
You were tiny. You were like...
I was little. Yeah, I was toddler, I think. Because I moved out of that house when I was like 3. So, very little. And, like, I guess my sister ran in, picked up the thing, and I crawled out, and I was fine.
You said it looked like somebody was
it
under
looked
it
like,
holding
well,
it
up. Looked like somebody was under it. Like I was under it. Oh, it looked like there was a body under it, and then I was fine. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened.
And so. You told your sister that a ghost lady had saved you.
Well, I believe I had mentioned in the past that of a ghost lady that I saw when I was little, like in my crib or something, or like in my playpen or whatever when I was going to sleep. But yeah. So that was. Maybe that was the Filgia literally guarding me.
Yeah.
You know?
I was telling a story. Maybe I've told this before. I don't think on the podcast, though. When I was young, me and my mother were... I was like 7 or 8 years old, probably. We were visiting my grandmother, who lived a few miles up the street. We had been there throughout the day, and it was nighttime. It was dark out. And we left to leave, and we got in the car in the driveway, just us two. So I was sitting up front next to my mom in the driver's seat. And when she went to start the car, like she put the keys in, it's very dark out, no street lights. This bright white sphere of light, like the size of a golf ball or a tennis ball maybe, rose up from the center console into the air between us. At about head height, maybe a little bit higher, and got brighter. It was already super bright. It was solid white light, perfectly spherical, and then it just like vanished in a flash of light. And my mom looked at me and didn't say anything. She just looked at me with this awkward silence for a minute, and then she went to start the car, and I didn't say anything either. I was in complete shock.
Okay, hey everybody, sorry about that. David was in the middle of telling a story about his mom, and his mom called, and the recording paused. So, go ahead, finish.
Yeah, so I think where I was at, that ball of light rose up between us and disappeared, and she looked at me, and then she went to start the car again after pausing for a minute, and as soon as she did that, the ball of light... Same exact thing happened, identically, from the same spot, rose up for a minute, and then disappeared. And my mom didn't say anything directly about it. She just said, I think we're not supposed to drive right now. Or she said, I think we're supposed to stay here tonight. Something like that. So we got out of the car, and we went inside, and just spent the night there. And then the next morning, it was like it never happened. Like, she never talked about it. But that really just woke me up and... changed my life, because I was like, what was that? And why aren't people talking about stuff like this all the time? Like, whatever people were focused on seems really not important compared to what just happened to me.
Yeah.
And things like that that exist in this world. What is going on? So that set me on the path as someone, you know, seeking the mysteries, as it were. And I think now with what I know about the lore of those things, that I saw my follower, my fetch, and before I was gonna die, it was like, I think if we drove, maybe we would have died, but we didn't drive, and so we're still alive, and that set me on this whole crazy path that I've been on. So yeah, that was my story with it. I have other stories, but
I got a question about that, actually.
Uh-huh.
Are you sure that your mom also saw it and she wasn't just feeling something? Like, did she look at it and shit?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, interesting.
She looked at it.
Okay. Well, so, What about the part where the fetch can also be an animal? You guys were talking about the
freak Yeah, animal. So it shows up as animals. There's different forms of animals and the contrasexual being, and then also a geometric shape. And I was just thinking this before when we were talking about it, how Frank talks about this woman. Last night, or the other night, we were talking about Carl.
Wait, the fetch can show up as a geometric shape also? So that sphere was like a geometric shape?
It can show up as a geometric shape, and they say that, like, just like people have spirit animals, like, people have different geometries that have different teachings of, like, their soul for them. That, like, for some people it's the same, for some people it's different, but, yeah, it shows up as different shapes for people.
What's my shape?
I don't know what your shape is.
I'm going to be a trapezoid.
You can be a trapezoid. All right. And, well, I was talking about Carl Jung. We were talking about Carl Jung and archetypes, and I was saying he's this one of, if not the greatest magicians of our age, and he knew to be respected, he had to exclusively talk in materialistic scientific frameworks, but he was talking about things that go beyond those frameworks. So instead of saying gods, he had to invent a new word, archetype, in a new context, but he was talking phenomenologically about these things that go beyond, but he was able to talk about it in a materialistic way.
Well, in an empirical way.
In an empirical way. And, yeah, that's a better word for it. In an empirical way, which he studied and replicated results of things. And I think his anima and animus is the one of the ways that the fetch shows up. The philgia shows up as a woman or a man. And I think that he was describing that phenomena without knowing it, basically. But that, to me, seems like the same thing. The animal forms, I was trying to remember exactly what they are earlier, but, and it can change, obviously, but they would have three different ones that, basically, the animal that you're most like, and the animal that you feel like is the most protective form, like the thing that would protect you most. And then there's also one that is whatever scares you most. And that's almost like a shadow integration teacher that is there to teach you things, but it does it through the shape of your fears, specifically in the context of animal spirits in this context. But, you know, the way that animals do things being symbolic, metaphorical teachers for us. So, yeah, that was the animal stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I can just keep going on.
Well, like, how would somebody find out what kind of animal fetch? Would it appear in a dream?
Dreams.
Would they see it in real life? How would that be
dreams
discerned?
I think it's hard to say. Like, I had, in that, at that same house where I was leaving and the ball of light came up. I lived there when I was a kid, and every day for years, many years, like 3 years at least, I had the same dream every single night where I would wake up out of my bed in the dream. Like, my astral body was like, okay, I'm up now. And I was in the same spot where I was sleeping, but really I was still in bed. But it was like, the dream was that I got out of bed and it was dark out, and I was in the house that I was in. It was dark. I walked through the house, down through the kitchen, through the steps, into the basement, and to the left there was a laundry room. To the right there was what we called a game room. It was just like a finished basement room. And in the left there was a Black Panther that if I went in there, the Black Panther would eat me and kill me. And if I went into the right, there was a male lion with a mane that would kill me and eat me. And the only choice I had was, which one do I want to eat me tonight? It was basically, I was on like a track, like every night. It happened so much that I knew what was going to happen and there was no surprise. And I just picked which one I felt like being eaten by. So cats are a super huge spirit for me in my life. And, you know, there's different spirits that show up for people at different times, but something like that is, even I'll have different messengers that come through and different things, but a cat is a thing that is consistent. It's not
me the phone. Yeah, Kat is consistent. I guess I was just wanted to add that in one of his writings, I forget which one it was. I think it's, can't remember. It's in the Equinox, but Crowley talks about crossing the abyss. There's a story where a guy is telling a fairy tale to a lady about crossing the abyss, and it involves allowing oneself to be eaten by a giant cat, and that's like the accomplishment. And if you're, and it's like, I think in the story, the lady is afraid and like unwilling to let herself be eaten, and she sort of fails the spiritual test at hand. The test is to willingly sacrifice oneself, which is also a part of the story of the Buddha. You know, in his last life before he was the Buddha, there was like a hungry tiger who was so hungry she was going to eat her own cubs, and the Bodhisattva who became Gautama Buddha was like, oh, you can eat me instead, don't eat your cubs, let me spare you that, just eat me. And that, I guess, preceded his complete enlightenment.
There's, yeah, the shamanic stories, or I don't know, pattern of being dismembered over and over again in the underworld as a part of coming into being as a healer or whatever. That's a thing that they say happens in all cultures, and I've kind of thought of it as that in the past, but what you just said makes sense to me, because I really do feel like it was some kind of training, and at first I think I was scared a lot, but by the time it stopped happening, I had no fear of it. It was just matter of fact.
Was there pain in the dream?
There wasn't pain. There was the cat coming in, like, as soon as it would start to eat me, I would wake up.
Okay.
It was like, I think the cat is big enough, you know, to pounce and bite my neck or whatever and kill me almost instantly. So it was like the death in the dream was me waking up in this dream. Waking up in this dream.
Well,
But so I was saying that I don't know what people's spirits are. I'm not going to tell you like a prescription, because it's not that cut and dry. You have to just be paying attention and developing a relationship with your higher self and your discernment and your intuition and lots of things to.
Yeah. So I like that you made the connection clear between the fetch and like Jung's discussion of the anima, animus. I definitely agree. Those seem like precisely the same things that he calls them. Calls the anima and the animus the great mediating daimons of the unconscious, which obviously the unconscious is just the mystery, the unknown. And I also think there's a way in which, just to fully make the connection, that the fetch is synonymous with the holy guardian angel. You know, its various faces are the faces of this inner companion, this, you know, great genius that when not treated with respect, I feel like endlessly defeats you. And when treated with a lot of like, you know, careful reverence and studious interaction, mainly through paying attention to one's dreams, although there can also be waking visions and synchronicities that guide one. You know, open up just wonder, just like fountains of wonder has been my experience. So
that has to do with the hamingya.
Yeah, to the pass positive. It to Frank. Frank, tell us about the hamingya.
The positive interactions with the philia create luck for you, essentially. There are like I think that one of the biggest builders of hamingya is following through with your word, your actions matching your words. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Okay. It sounded like you were about to say something.
What? I was just, we didn't get into the hamar as part of the hamingya. I feel like it's connected to that for sure.
Yeah.
Well, explain what the hamar is. People don't know what these words mean.
You can explain it. I'll add on to what you say.
So, it's...
It means shape or skin.
Skin, yeah. It's like your. Oh, jeez. I don't know. I'm drawing a blank right now.
It's,
you're killing me.
Astral body is probably the word you're looking for.
It's, it is a projection that, yeah.
It's, I think if we, people talk like about glamour, yeah, like glamour yeah. and glamour magic, the way that a really good actor can make themselves seem almost unrecognizable as the same person from one role to the next. It's like they're two completely different people. It's this way that you can change the shape of your identity so that it has a perceivable effect in other people. So people looking at you see you as different because you're seeing yourself as different. There's this old story about Marilyn Monroe on a subway. Maybe she was traveling with a news reporter or something. I don't remember who was telling the story. But she was herself, and nobody was noticing her. And she was like, "You want to see something cool? Watch this." And he said that it was like she turned a light on inside of herself, and all of the sudden, everybody was like, "Oh my God, it's Marilyn Monroe." And people started flocking around her. And she was just showing she had such deep control over that inner plastic substance of self-image that is externally perceivable in your electromagnetic field. People can feel it in the way that your mannerisms and your facial expressions show up. We talk about Dr. Robert's stuff a lot, and it's like changing your mental maps and inner representations of reality in a way that you can heal yourself. But I think that that's the same thing as what the Hometer is. It's the ability to change your internal representation, whether that's of your own identity and beliefs or of some astral substance or structure that you're using to interact with. You know, it's changing your subjective inner world in a way that other people perceive you differently. That external perception of other people was how they talked about it in the sagas. They talk about Hamarar, which meant shape strong, or Egi Einhamar.
So that was the phrase that I was getting stuck on earlier, not of one skin, Egi Einhamar. So that's the quality of being able to easily change your outward projection, energetic projection on people. And I don't know why I never likened it to glamour, but that is exactly what it is. I'm speaking in like the old druidic magic shape shifting sense, not like the magazine sense.
Yeah. And so with keeping your word and luck, this connection between these things as a substance, I think, you know, reality comes into being through the paths of least resistance. And if somebody always keeps their word and does the thing that they say that they're going to do, whenever at some point they just declare, "I'm going to do this thing," it's like the patterns of being and thought form have a topological shape, like a groove that's been worn in to the surface of the collective consciousness, so that reality starts to pour into whatever their will says. And they say they're going to do things, luck, things start manifesting. It's like that alone becomes a spell. They don't have to write a petition and invoke a god. They just say it because they always keep their word. It becomes a powerful thing. And that, I think, is the essence of luck. This is the old saying that, like, preparation is the best thing for good luck, or something like that. Like, luck loves being prepared, or something like that. It's speaking to there's this mundane thing that supports it, and people will write it off as just that. But it goes beyond that. When you're repeatedly on point, it starts to actually have a magical effect where things do fall into place, and there's serendipity and synchronicity for you that isn't there for other people who flake on their word. And that becomes like keeping your word becomes a part of the shape of your identity in a literal sense, at a more subtle frequency of vibration than what we think of as physicality. But I see it literally as topological or topographical. I don't know the word, but there's this shape to it. And
I often use the metaphor, I'm pretty sure I heard it from you at some point in the past, of a mountain. Your brain is like a mountain, or whatever. In this case, I guess your spirit is like a mountain. And, like, the things you choose to think about, the things you put your energy towards are like, water sources coming from the cap of the snowy cap of the mountain melting and funneling down to the bottom, and they take these certain channels. And the more you reinforce certain thoughts and actions, the deeper the channels get. And the this little babbling brook becomes a river, becomes a waterfall, you know, whatever. And that's, you know, the first step to that is your actions matching your words, but then it goes to a point where your thoughts start to shape your reality. When you think the right way and act the right way, you get that good luck and things just start happening for you.
I want to take this off maybe, or just beyond. We were talking about apotheosis the other day.
Yeah.
And speaking of this just makes me think of...
We'll define that.
Well, I'll get there in a second. But Carl Jung talked about archetypes in an essay called Wotan, about Odin as a very important forgotten archetype in the collective consciousness. But he likened it to a dry riverbed. So it had such a deep groove for such a long time. It's almost like the Grand Canyon. Like there's a groove there that's not going away, and all it needs is the waters of consciousness to start filling it again so that it can be tapped and utilized. And that's like a God level groove in the same sort of topology of consciousness that we're talking about. I just saw an article the other day. I don't even read it, but I think it was likening
like the idea.
How did you know?
Well, I saw the headline and it was likening, it was saying that they connected quantum entanglement with topography and saying that it has a thing like that. I could be confusing two different things, but it was a novel. I was like, oh, wow, that makes sense to me, but I've never heard anyone say that, and they were doing studies on it. So just throwing that out there. But we're talking about this God-level thing with Odin being that riverbed, but also doing the same thing consistently enough with your will in the world, creating grooves of yourself and stepping into that sort of self-deification,
yeah.
Which is what... how Frank was defining apotheosis. The word itself just means the highest point in the development of a thing.
Yeah, right. So self-deification. And I feel like when one hears that term, at least when I hear that term, like a certain grandiosity springs to mind. Like it sounds like puffing oneself up, or even like what Jung would call being inflated with an archetype. But I think what it actually is, like I think that's what people might mistake it for, but I think what it actually is it's rising up the golden chain of being. So I'm thinking about, we're probably going to put Ludo in this school that's connected to Emanuel Swedenborg, who's this, mystic, Swedish mystic from the 18th century. And Swedenborg had this idea that it sounds true to me, which is that every demon, every angel, every god was once human, or has had a human incarnation, or there's some weird time loopy thing going on where even the creator of the universe,
that's,
you know,
called euhemerism.
What is it called?
Euhemerism. It was Greek. There was a Greek philosopher that posited this about all of the gods, that it was like stories about humans that over time they became these divine archetypes. His name, I forget, but that belief is called euhemerism.
Okay, well, or even that the creator of the universe, you know, also is a human, like Jesus or Hercules or Orpheus or something, some guy who was Odin and also the god Odin, you know. Anyhow, this funky sort of figure eight relationship between God and divinity. And, you know, Frank and I were talking about this, and I think, like, one of the ways that it starts, like, one of the ways that apotheosis starts, is, I guess we could call it achieving a kind of sainthood, in the sense that you start to appear as an archetypal symbol to other people.
You become mythologized.
You become, yeah, so there's, like, you appear in many other people's dreams as a kind of numinous figure. People develop, like, legends about you without you knowing at first. Like, there's this whole sort of mythologization process that's not just, like, you bragging about yourself or you whatever.
Well, it's it's you following your word and doing awesome shit, and that's you making that groove for yourself. And all your dominion showing up.
I think I get what Carolyn's saying too. Like, there's a lot of left hand path edge lords that are into self deification, and it makes me roll my eyes. And it's like, I think there's a lot of deep stuff behind that, but a lot of people misinterpret it in this way that Carolyn's talking about. But I was just thinking, to me, it's about remembrance. And Carolyn's wanting the phone. I guess I'll finish my thought in a moment.
Sorry. I'm sorry to butt in. I guess I just wanted to add what I was... It is about remembrance, completely about remembrance. And that I was just excited to tell you, listeners at home, something that I had been telling Frank the other day, which was about, you know, I'm writing these emails that'll go out probably pretty soon talking about Florence Farr. And Florence Farr was a founding, I don't know, quite founding. She was an important member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. She was a celebrated actress and singer, and she was a prolific Egyptologist, one of the first Egyptologists. And I find it really fascinating because Florence Farr, you know, she had this deep relationship with a mummy in the British Museum, and she would, like, look into this mummy's eyes, and it would basically give her deep transmissions and deep memories of a past life that she felt that she had as this mummified person who was a scribe, I believe, and would, you know, would take records down for the temple and was, like, in charge of caring for the temple library. And this figure just gave her this all sorts of information about types of meditations to do that would, you know, enhance the cause of spiritual growth. So she developed sort of her own separate faction within the Golden Dawn where they would work on these meditations that had been given to her through this Egyptian statue mummy thing. And I was just reflecting that, like, so I have had these really deep dreams with Florence Farr, where she is teaching me things. She's showing me things in magic, and she's connecting me with various Egyptian deities. And it seems to me that Florence Farr is succeeding in at least the first level of self-deification, where she has become an angelic teaching figure for me, just as her Egyptian statue in the museum, mummy statue, I forget exactly what the deal was for her. And so, you know, and even Frank was saying cool stuff about, like, how, you know, in order to grow, you have to teach, you know, you learn further things by teaching. And probably she is in a stage of, she's expanding as a soul, as a bodhisattva deity, whatever, doing her thing in her relationship with me. And I just think that's so freaking cool. Like, and she, you know, obviously she is that older Egyptian being, and she's other stuff. And anyways, it's just, I can feel her as part of my extended self. Obviously, we're all ultimately part of the same self, but we have these faces of the fetch, faces of the great daimon that are fractal, closer to us in the fractal arrangement. And I experienced my encounters with Florence Farr in those dreams as a deep remembering and a deep reintroduction to some truths that I had just become unconscious of.
Yeah, thank you. I think that teaching aspect of it is really key to being remembered. You think of like Plato or Socrates as these examples that, you know, as long as there's intellectual history and memory, people will probably remember those names and talk about them. And they are sort of archetypes within consciousness at this point for English speaking people of the Western world. And I think a lesser, like, I was just thinking, like, Bonnie and Clyde, something like that. People that did something notorious that wasn't necessarily
virtuous or
helpful. People still remember it and talk about it in ways, I guess, that it's romantic because we live in a world that's overly safe. So people that go outside the bounds in this sort of anti-hero way is heroic and memorable. But think down the line, like, in how many thousands of years of the human race, you know, spreads to other planets and continues to grow and everything, how long are people really going to remember Bonnie and Clyde compared to Socrates? So there's just the degree to which you can help people and perpetuate the evolution of a body of knowledge that is translinear in time, like Carolyn's talking about. The role of tradition itself is tapping into these principles that go beyond time and passing them on inside the realm of time. It's like, how do these principles live and get passed on in this realm of time? And when we can step into that and connect with those principles and the passing on of them, we enter into that field of remembrance itself. And yeah, I see that remembrance as like a key kernel to my own personal work. And it's like, if my fetch had a word, it would be remember. And I haven't reached the point of wanting to teach the philosophy of that yet, but it's the core kernel of my own pursuits and a lot of the work that we do together. I wanted to hear Frank's.
Well, so on the topic of remembrance, it's interesting to me. The concept that is embodied in the metaphor of Valhalla is like reincarnation and remembrance of your past lives. That's what it means to live, to, you know, die and wake up and fight again every day. Yeah, that's like the, I mean, I don't know. Do you have a similar?
Well, I could say, I think I do agree. And I think of how even outside of the Norse stuff, the word yoga, which is really common, means yoked. And like religion means like the binding of a thing. I can't think of the word, but the ligands, the things that bind things together.
Ligaments,
yeah. Religion's connected to that word. So there's like this yoking of oneself to God, of the finite self to the infinite self. And all of the Vedic stuff says that if you die in battle, you are automatically completely yoked to God.
Yeah.
And that's analogous to the Norse stuff of Valhalla and Folkvang, the lesser known Freya's hall, that people who died in battle would go to her hall. Half of them would go to there. The other half would go to Valhalla.
I always said I'd rather go to Folkvang because instead of having an old man with one eye sitting at the top, at least that one has nice boobs.
Yeah. Yes. So to me, I have actual memories of such things happening, but to me, it's dying in battle doesn't even necessarily have to mean literally that. I think it could mean that you've awakened to the point of understanding what is the divine purpose that you're here. That's like the thing that you're willing to die for in pursuit of. And willing to die for means you understand that it's more important than anything else in your life, and everything else is subject as an offering to that thing, which is your purpose. And when you die in service of that thing,
mm-hmm.
you are yoked to the infinite, and you have a remembrance that continues on this substance of haminga, your bandwidth of connection to all that is. So when you're born again, you're not starting from scratch. You've reached like a save checkpoint, essentially, in the journey of incarnations.
This reminds me rather of what it means to be a warrior. What it actually means to be a warrior.
Right.
And, well, okay, so I can't... Let me just give you my take on it. So people can be... you can be a martial artist, a soldier, a fighter, an accomplished killer, whatever, an assassin, a mercenary. A warrior is not something that you are all the time. The word warrior, in my mind, at least, it means someone who is willing to die for their in service of their dharma, so to speak, without hesitation, with fear. You're scared, but you're going to do it anyway. That minuscule amount of time where you make that split decision is when you are or are not a warrior. That's the way I always looked at it.
And that seems connected to the Buddha being eaten by the tiger. It's like willingness to sacrifice yourself in service of a higher good.
Yeah.
In many ways is... I don't know if animals do that or not, but it seems like self-preservation is a very animalistic thing.
Animals who do that get to become humans next time. Pretty sure that's how it works.
I like that.
I'm pretty sure that's the general gist in like how it's understood in Buddhism too, is that, yeah, animals who are able to sacrifice themselves for others get to become human. That's one of the ways anyway. But, yeah, it's so beautiful and deep to think about. And as you guys were talking, I was thinking about, I've been pondering a lot lately the phrase that Jesus said, you know, take up your cross and follow me. And I forget which essay, where it is somewhere, but Jung talks about, you know, what does that mean to, like, psychologically, like, take up one's cross? And it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, being martyred. But what it means is, you know, sacrificing the ego's purposes or the ego's conscious ideals, like, for something in the larger self. And one way that I've been experiencing that lately is I get taken over by, like, very negative, I might call them, like, negative animus projections. Maybe it's a negative mother complex. Who knows? But it takes me over, and I get very possessed by it, and I project it, and I experience all this hostility and negativity around me, which is actually a part of me. And so far, one of the most effective ways I've found to internally deal with it, well, we can tell you in a minute about how else David and I work with it, but one of the ways I internally deal with it is I say to it, okay, cause me whatever pain you like. Me and the people around me, just ruin it, ruin our days, eat us up, just take me. Go ahead. It's more important that you get to have your expression, you get to have your whatever upset or alienation that you want to have. That's way more important than that I get to have the harmonious family life that my ego thinks that I want. So you win, baby. You take it. You do it. And it's like, as soon as I relax and like willingly give it that, it lifts up off of me, and it's not able to possess me in the same way. And I just find that very interesting. And of course, the analogy springs up that that's fairly similar to the Tibetan Chod practice, where practitioners willingly offer themselves to be eaten by their demons. It's pretty much the same principle. And then another thing that David and I have found that really works when I'm in this state, which as somebody might call like being triggered, like having a trauma trigger would be like the modern parlance for it, I guess, is to make, David started doing it in a stroke of genius. He made the Gorgon face at me, this like cross-eyed, tongue out.
Yeah, I went to the Met in New York with my son over Christmas break, and they had a picture of, they had an actual Gorgon shield in there.
Like a people shield used to make shields against the Gorgons.
Well, no, people would put Gorgons because, like, we have a Gorgon at our house. It's like an apotropaic magic that you would use against your enemies. It's protective magic, yeah. Is a Gorgon face. Athens had them on their shields. Yeah. And so they had this shield there, and it's just, like, an amazing Gorgon face with the snake hair and everything. It's like the Versace logo or whatever. But the eyes are super crossed and the tongue is sticking out and like pointing up. And it's just like a silly ass face that is funny. And I made it at Carolyn once when she was like really in the thick of one of these projection possessions. And it just like broke the spell faster than anything I've ever seen, and she started laughing. And so we've been using that and playing with that a lot. I was just coming back around to all the stuff we're talking about, this just thinking of the apotheosis and remembrance. And like Carolyn's talking about what she does with these patterns with herself. She's telling me recently about these ideas. Marie-Louise von Franz, if you want to talk about how you have to have contact with the self before you can do this, maybe you want to say a few words on that. I'll continue the thought.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this. So I've been reading and rereading just one of my favorite books ever, which is called Projection and Recollection by Marie-Louise von Franz, who is one of Jung's close pupils. And this time I read it, a line just really jumped out at me that I'd never jumped out at me before. And she talks about how it's impossible for anybody to recollect or integrate an unconscious content like an anima or animus projection or shadow projection, whatever, unless they have already experienced a personification of the self in dreams. So unless they've had basically like contact with their fetch Filja, they're not their holy guardian angel, they're not able to do the work of reintegration. And I thought this was really struck me as so deep because you know, I'm really into Thelema, and one of the big things in Thelema is you know, Crowley was super inspired by the sacred magic of Abramelin the mage. And in that old grimoire, the idea is that the magician has to come into contact with the holy guardian angel before they can summon and command all of these various demons in the name of the angel, which is the same principle as Solomonic magic. That's what King Solomon is said to have done, as he summoned and commanded the spirits of the Goetia under the authority of the 72 angels of the Shem HaFeresh, you know, the names, the angels of God. And it's the way that I've been thinking about it lately is that these, you know, these sort of like negative possessing or projecting parts are, they're fragmented. Like, they're not updated. They're not connected with the whole truth of everything I know about myself and David, for example. They're like cut off in some way from the full intelligence and larger consciousness. And that in order, it just makes sense to me that in order for me to be able to recognize a projection and reintegrate it, I have to know that there is a a self larger than my ego that includes everything, that is, you know, God, that is numinous, and that I don't have to be afraid of, like, say, for example, like the hostility within me, the evil within me, that it's part of me. It has to exist. There's no way for it not to exist within the realm of manifest duality. Like, it has to have its place. And trying to completely deny it its place will never get rid of it. It can only make it more powerful by pushing it deeper into the unconscious, where it can act in more mischievous, sideways fashion. Whereas that move, that sort of self-sacrificial move of like, hey, you're here, cause me as much pain and upset as you would like, you can ruin my time, ruin all of my friends' time, please do that. that attitude just is real love and gives that part what it needs. And I'm only able to do that because I've had contact with the real love from my larger self, my fetch, my HGA, whatever. And so, yeah, it's this virtuous circle, I guess, of redemptive love. And again, that goes back to this like golden chain of being, that like, I am the redeeming angel to the fragmented, confused parts of myself, just as my fetch or my HGA, you know, is my redeeming angel.
Yeah, and that golden chain of being, like the great chain of being, I like the golden aspect. in this gold being a substance that doesn't erode or decay. And I see the transcendent principles as that, and tradition itself as, in the deepest sense, a marriage of opposites between static and dynamic things, something that never changes and something that's always changing. Tradition is this pure merger of those things, in that there's a set number of principles or forms that actually are eternal and don't change. And traditions work with coming to understand and invoke and embody and eventually identify with those eternal things, which are the form of the self. And they get passed on in this dynamic world of change from generation to generation. The forms stay the same. They're the golden top of the chain. And, you know, the LBRP, rune work, any of these things where, like, mandalas, this Jungian idea of the circle with the four gates, the squaring of the circle, there's you working with these forms in the astral body, calling them into your hammer in a way that, whether you mean to or not, eventually you make contact with the self and you have an identification loosening of your ego. You no longer identify with your ego
exclusively.
I mean, you still have it. You're still centered inside of your body that's gonna die, and the temporariness of it gives beautiful meaning to the experience that you're here having. But you also are aware of this deeper, more everlasting truth that you also can now identify with. So originally you asked, like, how can people do this thing? Keep your word and study eternal forms.
Flood the grooves.
And yeah, the grooves are made by these eternal forms.
They're just waiting for your attention. They're waiting for you to fill them with the fluid of your thought.
I think of that like the within, talking Carolyn's example of this Jungian sense, it's personal and transpersonal with the Solomonic stuff. It's like we have a transcendent self, and then there's personal demons or complexes, however they want to be described, within our psyche. But then the demons are these collective version of the same thing that exist within the collective of masses of humanities as like a hive organism, you know. Yeah, mob mentality. There's a different age level maturity of a bunch of humans when they get together versus whenever there's just one of them.
People have done studies on this.
Like, yeah,
this
exactly.
Mob mentality is some real shit.
So I think that's where deep magic comes in, and what the Solomonic stuff is talking about, that contact with the self that allows you to direct these collective complexes and grooves in accordance with your ego's will. But it's not really your ego's will, because your ego is now in service to the higher self, and that's almost the pre-requirement of being able to command those forces and not being destroyed by them. And so I think that's really the root of really powerful magic and powerful healing of self and other in the collective, and those two things are really pretty intertwined.
Is to kill off the ego in service to your dharma warrior stuff. I don't know, I'm just thinking.
Ironically and paradoxically helps to empower the standing of your ego in the world, usually.
Well, it's like the ego as, I mean, the ego is itself, in Jungian terms, the ego is itself a complex, and it's a complex that seemingly needs renewal. Like, it needs to die and be reborn. And, like, that's, you know, in the Gospels of Thomas, like, die before you die. Like, you just have to...
Those who die before they die don't die when they die.
So it's like allowing one's like ego attachments to die as repeatedly as one can. And, you know, and of course the ego always reassembles like lickety split. I mean, not always. I guess there's people suffering from things like schizophrenia and terrible traumas that, but in a healthy person, you can afford some ego dissolution, sacrifice on a regular basis. Your ego will reassemble in a more, refreshed form. So, like, for example, I was doing dream work and I was, like, dialoguing with, like, various parts of my psyche, and I experienced this, and I was undergoing these changes in my attitudes. And I had a dream where I was talking to this old man who was, like, he looked like an old Chevy Chase or an old Ted Danson. And he was, like, proud of me, but he was, like, sick and dying. And I could see that, you know, on, like, later reflection, that he was sort of, like, a male chauvinist, like, old-fashioned set of certain attitudes that I had had. Like, certain, I don't know how to describe it, but just, like, certain self-centered attitudes was this, like, because I associate Chevy Chase with, you know, hi, I'm Chevy Chase and I'm a big deal sort of thing, right? I'm kind of a big deal. That was, like, his line on Saturday Night Live. And but he was old and sick and dying. And it's, like, the old dying king, like, goes away and then, like, a new ego function gets reborn. So that is just one little representation of that.
Talk about my weird ideas about spiritual awakening, puberty kind of thing. Because, like, the thing is, a lot of people don't have opportunities to experience ego death in everyday life, you know? It's not something necessarily that just pops up. Like, I guess sometimes under extreme circumstances, but a lot of times the only outlet people have for that consistently is through entheogens. And I think a lot of, you know, cultures, like pre-Abrahamic taking over the world influence cultures, had rites of passage, usually involving entheogens, and everyone in the tribe went through them to some extent. They had to experience that kind of ego death. And so a lot of people had made some connection with their higher self, I think. And one of the biggest problems with, I think one of the biggest problems with modernity is the separation of most, like, the individual from the divine collective in general. And I think this is why, like, I've met a lot of atheists who are just angry at people who have spiritual connections for no good reason other than the fact that they have them. And I sort of chalk this up to, like, a person in this situation, in that mindset, hasn't experienced any kind of spiritual awakening. Like, there are chemical processes that happen in your brain when you feel a spiritual connection to something. And I think that once that happens, your brain changes its chemistry forever. And those connections are no longer, like, you know, they're there and they can't be unmade, at least not easily. And people who haven't undergone that transformation, that chemical process, whatever, that spiritual connection, can't even, like, conceive of it. Mm-hmm. So they think that it's like that old saying, like, the, you know, about people who can hear the music dance and the ones who can't hear it think the ones that dance are crazy, whatever that, you know, that one. It's literally that. They're prepubescent in the spiritual way.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, we live in a, like, a super adolescent, weird culture. Like, materialism is definitely stultifying in a million different ways and, like, creates just, like, such alienation and such suffering. And I feel hopeful. Yeah, because, well, that's what brings us together has been our alienation and suffering. Well, and also, you know, like, I think a place like Tulum is so popular, obviously, for its natural beauty, and because there's something about the natural beauty here that just makes people be like, wow, there is something incredibly holy going on, and we need to relate to that. Let's do that. And, you know, not that there's not a dark side to the party culture here or anything, but, like, there definitely is also a lot of people who are very tapped in and, like, very seeking to help others tap in, and a lot of beautiful souls here, too. And it is lovely because I do feel like the materialist, you know, fake science hegemony is going to die, like, will not hold, will not be able to withstand. It's in its death throes. It cannot withstand Pluto and Aquarius and all of the aliens in Miami and, you know, the AI people coming in.
When you stand far enough back and you look at it, at their big castle, that isn't there. It looks big and strong, and all the stones look like they're well put together. But when you get closer and you actually look at it, that mortar is crumbling.
Yes, the mortars of modernity are crumbling. Mordor is crumbling. Mordor is crumbling. Yeah, it's so interesting. And yeah, I feel like it's a big effort that, you know, our wonderful listeners are probably definitely engaging in a deep way, is this effort of integration and recollection and remembering. And, like, what does it take to bring all of the fragmented parts back into proper, loving relationship? It's a huge heroic effort, is what it seems to take, because it's gotten, everything has gotten so out of whack. And maybe I know that our recording time will be cut off after an hour. Maybe I'll sort of end it on this note. I recently rewatched all the Harry Potter movies with Lulu. And I just thought it was so cool about how, you know, Harry has an encounter with evil when he's a kid. Because Voldemort kills his parents, tries to kill him. And then he has this lightning-shaped scar. Which is a Sawilo rune. And he becomes a Horcrux of Voldemort, which means he has a piece of Voldemort inside of him. And I've experienced that as... That sounds very psychologically accurate to me, you know, like once one has had an encounter with evil, as we all have in the form of like the various traumas that modernity has inflicted on us and our parents and all of the pain that has radiated down into us, it becomes a part of you and you cannot get rid of it. And just, you know, like Harry has special gifts that Voldemort, you know, gives him, like he can understand the snake language. And he also sometimes feels tempted to act in very naughty ways because the Voldemort bits are in him. And it's like, yeah, once you've got that, you've been touched by evil, it's there within you, you have to reckon with it. And I find it very beautiful that he does that self-sacrificial thing, right? Like he willingly gives himself to be killed by Voldemort, and then he is, like, immediately resurrected. Yeah, he's yoked with God. And yeah, that's, I mean, props to J.K. Rowling, because she did actually have a very deep alchemical understanding, and I never fully appreciated it because, I don't know, I never saw all the movies or read all the books, but I finally buckled down and did it. And hey, I was in high school when the Harry Potter books came out. I was too cool for them by that time, but anyhow, it was fun watching it with Lulu. And I think it's a great myth and a great spell that she cast, and is just the truth about how things work. Like, it's the same thing that I was talking about earlier, like willingly sacrificing to the evil within and being like, evil, you have a right to exist too, you know? Cool. Kill me. That's what you want to do? That's what will really make you happy? I want you to be happy, evil demon thing that lives inside of me. I really want you to be happy and have what you want, so go ahead and do it. And it's like, it takes that level of love to be in relationship with that.
All right, I think that was a good amount of juice having been squeezed for tonight. We can save some extra for further Tulum podcasts here.
Yeah. All right, thanks for tuning in, everybody. So, you know, be sure to... like, subscribe, follow, tell your friends about Sleepover Podcast. You can go to carolynlovewell.com and join the email list. I'm going to be sending out these emails soon about Florence Farr and stuff that I learned about her from her. And yeah, thank you so much. You are incredibly awesome. Have a wonderful night, day, whatever it is. Bye-bye.